Welcome, everybody. We're hoping, I was joking with Travers before we got started here that I'm having some technical difficulties today, so I'm hoping that everything is good here. Welcome to the next episode. I think it's episode 17 now.
Got to be 17 now. Yeah,
yeah. 17 now. And yeah, let's just jump right in. We're going to start the segment as we always do. I'm applying a change to the camera here. Nothing like doing all this on the fly. With our movies of the week recommendations. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Well, I watched the first four episodes of Fallout this week.
Thoughts?
So, I love it. It's great. And I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I think I said last week, we're on a strict rationing plan. Like, because I could binge watch the whole thing in a weekend.
Sure.
So I've said to Karen, I'm like, it's like one episode a night. And then whether we like it or not, we're going to go find something else to do because I'm trying to spread it out over like a week and a half. Because I think it's only eight episodes, right?
There's only eight episodes. Yeah. Yeah. So you get one a day for a week.
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't seem like enough, right? But yeah. Anything else on your watch list?
That's pretty much it for new stuff we watched. We watched, rewatched Footloose over the weekend. That was
Footloose. Fun. There you go. That's a movie that I haven't seen in a long time. What was like Kevin Classic. Bacon, like 20?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe.
Insane.
Yeah.
So yeah, Fallout's on my list. Obviously we just talked about that. We also watched a really funny little movie. It's called Day Shift. Okay. Yeah. It's, Jamie Fox.
Yep.
I think it's Jamie Fox. Oh, and he's like a vampire hunter.
Yeah.
And he gets relegated to the day shift. It's just a fun little movie. We enjoyed it. So if you're, you know, not too serious, just kind of a fun to watch movie. So if you're looking for something to kill an hour and change with, that's good. And that reminds me, we watched another movie, Argyle. Have you seen Argyle? Oh, did I lose you?
You cameo in that.
Oh, there we go. Sorry, I lost you for a second. Did you hear me? I said, did you see Argyle? Oh, we're having audio issues today. Technical challenges, always fun in a live stream. Well, I'm sure Travers will join us back, but I watched Argyle, which I thought was a decent movie, but... my comment was, we were watching it. I'm like, how much longer is this movie on for? And ended up being like 2.5 hours or something like that, which I thought was a little long, but I liked it. I don't know. Travers, are you back? We can see Travers. We can't hear Travers. Travers, can you hear me? Well, we've completely, you know what? We're episode 17. There we go. He's coming back. Episode 17, first time we've ever had. There we go. He's back. Are you back? I see you muted now. I don't know if you can hear me or not. Bear with us a sec, folks. We'll get this technical issue sorted. I cannot. No. I see, hold on. I wonder if I can unmute you. Hang on. I see in the little interview room, you are muted. It says guests has muted themselves. Let me see if I can unmute you. I don't know. First time this has ever happened. I have no clue how to do this. Yeah, no, still can't hear you. Oh, okay. He's coming back. Let's see if we can get this sorted. Hey, are you there now?
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I don't know what happened there. That was weird.
Classic. The technical difficulties continue.
Of course. Never fails. I was saying, I don't know if you could hear me or not, but I was saying it's pretty good. We're 17 episodes in? And I think this is the first time we've had like a knock on wood and
major
audio
issue,
or like you got disconnected or anything. So anyways, let's pick up on the movie thing. One last thing. I'm not sure what you heard. We watched Argyle. Did you see
Arkham Knight? Oh, Arkham Knight was great. Yeah. Yeah. We watched that.
I liked it. I thought it was way longer than it needed to be. But I kind of said to Karen at one point, we're watching it, and I was like, how much longer do you think this is going to be on for? We actually broke it. I hate to say this because my attention span is so good. We broke it into two. We're kind of like, gotcha. Let's go do something else. And we came back and watched it a little late. Whoops, sorry. I'm messing with the camera here still. Went back and finished it up. I, in general, enjoyed it, though. So,
yeah, I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. Let's jump over. I've got my finely tuned order of announcements ready to go. So let's see.
All right.
Let's see if we survive a change. Can you still hear me?
Yep. Coming through just fine.
Okay. I do see some weirdness on the browser screen itself, but I'm not going to worry about it. So here's our first announcement. Maybe I'm going to be a little sentimental on this one, but when I saw this come along, I was like, oh, what a shame. I never quite understood how many actual use cases there would be for a device that could allow customers to move exabytes of data, but it sure made for fun. I was at this reInvent. It was 2016 when they announced it, and they rolled the tractor trailer onto the stage. And I kind of thought, you know, great theater. And I guess, you know, things change and not enough demand, maybe.
I guess so. Yeah, the context is they're decommissioning the snowmobile service, which is the semi-truck you could rent to move huge amounts of data over the real highway instead of the internet superhighway or information superhighway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess it says in the article that they used it once, essentially, for AWS to move a huge amount of data, and then here and there. So I think it's probably a demand thing.
Yeah. I got a good video of it, and I shared it on LinkedIn the other day. I'm like one of these people right here with their cameras up. I only half joked in the LinkedIn post. This was 2016. This is when you could get a decent seat at the reInvent keynote by just like waking up a little early and going lining it up, and you would get right in the front. Those days are long gone, but it's a bit of a shame. I think they talked about, for some reason, my recollection of this was when they announced it at reInvent, was like a satellite company or something like that had like obviously mass amounts of data.
Right.
And they used one of these things to move it. And I'm not sure if, again, I'm manufacturing that thing or not, that memory or not, but that's my recollection of this. But to your point, I guess, you know, sporadic use means at some point you got to cut these services, right?
Right. And the snow, the snowflake is still in service, the snowball, rather.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still never.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, never underestimate the bandwidth of sending hard drives over the highway, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I don't understand the snow family. This seems like a weird product name. I don't know. I'm getting hung up on product names, but I can tell you we've used the Edge devices a couple times in the past, and they do exactly what you expect them to do. They show up at your office, you plug them in, you transfer a whole bunch of data, the little Kindle updates, somebody comes and picks them up, and Amazon transfers that data for you. So as advertised, and what's really cool about them is you can create clusters of these machines if you've got like a large job, and you can kind of, as one of the devices gets filled up, you can ship it off and another one comes in its place. So the one thing, you know, when this first came out, this was a long, long time ago, so things might have changed now. But we did run into some customers that had rather steep overages for these devices. And I'm not familiar with the pricing model of these anymore because it has been a long time since I've actually seen one in use. But you've got the device for a certain number of days. And if you go over that, they start charging you for every day you don't send that device back. And, my takeaway from that is obviously you want to have a plan and the resources to actually do these transfer jobs before the device shows up.
Yeah, generally, if you're going to do one of these transfers, you know that you can't do it over a direct connect, and you should probably plan for it accordingly. Yeah.
Yeah, this reminds me of, the idea of having overages for devices sitting there not being used. Reminds me of the time I was working for a company, and we had very large IBM hardware at one point. And
okay.
I get the job, I go in, and, you know, it's my first week, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and they're like, oh yeah, well, I'm like, how do I get access to the servers and all that kind of stuff? I was working on something very specific. I won't say what, because it'll give too much away and people will figure it out. But they're like, oh, well, all of those servers are turned off. And I'm like,
oh,
what? And it was like racks of very expensive gear. And I was like, literally the first week turning them all back on. And we were drinking, they were like dusting stuff off. So, sometimes you can spend money on things that you don't end up using. So be careful with the snowball edge device. You don't want it hanging around your office forever and getting big bills. So yeah, it's too bad. But like you said, if there's really no use case for it, or at least not enough demand, then what's the point of keeping it around? Here's another one. Jira has a connector now for the well-architected tool. I know you most, I say you, but I didn't mean that. People either love Jira or hate Jira. I'm kind of I'm okay with Jira camp. We use it all the time. And this one just caught my eye because we use Jira, and this idea of doing regular well-architected reviews and having, when you're answering those questions, having it actually create for you items within Jira, tickets within Jira, that you can then track and resolve. And when you resolve them, it marks the item in your well-architected review as closed. So this just caught my eye. I think it's,
kind of interesting.
Yeah. If you're using these tools already and you want to integrate them together, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I kind of, I taught a class this week, and in the back of my head, I was like, I'm going to try to sit down and connect this from our demo account to our Jira instance, just to see what it does, and then go through a review and see what it does. But time got away from me. So looks like it's available in a lot of the commercial regions. So if you're using Jira, if you're using Jira, it might make sense.
Yeah.
This one's cool. So I've zoomed in too much. Let's try this again. There we go. CloudFormation change sets provide enhanced visibility for deployments.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So, we use change sets for everything.
Constantly.
I would say if you're using CloudFormation, you should absolutely be using change sets. It saved my ass a bunch of times where you're working very late at night and you just maybe need a little more sleep or something, and you think you're changing stack A, but you've actually made a change to stack B, and the change set is a nice little, are you sure you want to do this? Because CloudFormation will follow your instructions. And, again, if you don't have the right policies in place and things like that, you could end up deleting something and replacing it unintentionally. So a change set is fantastic, right?
Yeah, just it's essential, right?
Protect yourself from that.
Just to be able to see. And if you're not sure whether an update to a stack will cause a replacement or not, it's a good way to check, right? Just kind of validate beforehand before you actually run the deployment.
And this I did have a quick look at, and I think what I liked about it, obviously change sets, as I mentioned already, use them, right? Nice little safeguard. The thing that always got me on the change set was, okay, are we going to replace this? True, I think it was true or false, right? But then every once in a while, you got one of those ones that said, maybe.
Maybe. It might happen. I don't know. Yeah. Well, you're going to find out, I guess.
Yeah. Press go and let's see what happens. So what I noticed about this was exactly like it says here, you get a more detailed understanding of what CloudFormation is going to do on your behalf. And I drilled into it a little bit more. And it reminded me very much of, when you can run drift detection against your stacks, it has that same view. So now you can see sort of what's there and what's coming in the change set, and you can highlight the lines and look through it. So, I'm actually sort of really seen a situation where I was like, holy shit, that would have been bad. But it hasn't been out for very long, but I liked it just giving you a bit of a maybe better understanding or clearer understanding of the potential effects of your change.
That's really, all of these CloudFormation updates recently have just been amazing. Like, these are great changes that CloudFormation teams are doing. So thumbs up. It's great.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, even the, I noticed it the other day, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, you know, that change they made where, you know, they can kind of say, hey, this is done enough that you can move on and do the next thing. And I've actually noticed that a couple times over the last week or so. You know, I know it's anecdotal because I wasn't sitting there sort of timing the deployments of the stacks before.
Right.
But it does feel like some of the stacks that I would often sit around and wait for, go grab a coffee and stuff, seem to be deploying or updating much faster than they were prior to that change.
Makes a big difference. I found, especially with the VPC deployments, because of all the fiddly network resources that have to be deployed, they get spun up in parallel now, and it takes nowhere near as long, which it's awesome.
That's nice. Yeah. So this is, again, falls into the category of quality of life kind of updates that we often see and we often talk about. This thing here just, it can really save your ass, and now you've got even better understanding on what it's actually going to do before you do it, right? So that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here is one that I was super excited about. I have a funny story about this.
Okay.
So up until last week, you could get, what are the other models of Claude 3? You get, there's Haiku and Sonnet,
Haiku,
right?
And Sonnet, yeah.
Yeah. So you could get those, but you couldn't get Opus. And Opus is now available on Bedrock. But here's the thing. So, you know, I didn't really read this, and I saw a whole bunch of, you know, LinkedIn posts, social posts and stuff saying, Opus is there. Yay. So I'm like, cool, I want to go try it. And I log into our demo account where we've already got it. And I'm like, oh, it's not there. It's still marked coming soon. So in my brain, I was like, oh, well, maybe they're rolling it out over regions or over accounts or something. So I did that for like 2 or 3 days. I'm like, what the hell? Like, why can't I try this out? And then I, you know, did the old RTFM thing and went back and I was like,
right.
Oh, well, I'm in US East 1 and this is only in US West 2 or whatever, Oregon. So, it's always user error.
Always read the funny manual.
Yeah. So I changed my region and magically I could use Opus.
Great. How is it?
Do I really notice a difference between Opus and Sonnet? No. But to be honest, I wasn't quite sure what to expect because you know how much I've talked about Sonnet over the last 3-4 weeks. Like, it's just blown my mind on what it's been able to do for the type of thing that I'm doing with it. Like, I kind of always have it open and I'm asking questions.
Right.
I kind of use it as that we talked about last week as an AI companion. So I'm constantly going between it and whatever I'm working on. And I've been doing the same with Opus and
feels the same.
Like, I don't know how much difference there is here.
I guess you probably wouldn't, maybe you would need like a bigger context window to notice any difference or bigger task.
Yeah. So I still do a lot of bake-offs between ChatGPT 4 and Claude in this case. One of the things, and again, I'm taking prompt for prompt, right? So if I put a prompt into, let's say, Opus, I'm like, hey, what if I took that same prompt and dumped it into ChatGPT? What's it going to look like? And I would describe it like this. I'm thinking of an analogy that I think is right. Okay, so here we go. Travers,
yes,
you are Claude 3 Opus, okay?
Okay.
And I'm ChatGPT. And here's what I'm thinking. I tend to be a little more chatty than you. That's what, like, when I ask the same, like, it's like you're actually ChatGPT. It feels like you're talking to a person. Like, like, embellishing, and I don't mean to say that's coming off wrong. Yeah, it doesn't mean that talking to you isn't a person. But you're much more, Claude to me is much more direct. Like, I say, this, and it's like, here you go. Whereas if I ask ChatGPT to do the same thing, I'm it's telling me its life story before it gets to the point. Like, it's, and, you know, I don't know. That's, again, completely anecdotal, but it's a silly analogy, but that's kind of what I thought when I think about it, because I tend to chat a lot. Like, I'll yeah, I can't keep my mouth shut, right? And ChatGPT feels like that when I compare it to Opus.
Gotcha. It's interesting. I wonder if there's like a default temperature difference, maybe. Like, Claude is set to a lower temperature, so it generates a more deterministic result. I'd be curious to find out. I don't know if they release that info.
That's actually a good point, because like, I'm just using it in the playground, right? On Bedrock.
Right.
And there's all sorts of, down the right-hand sidebar, there's all sorts of
tuning
levers and stuff. And I haven't messed with that at all. I've literally just been... And again, because I've been so impressed with Claude just out of the box, like when I ask it something, I'm like, holy shit, like that's really good stuff. Or I could take it and sort of ask it another question. The large context has been fantastic, but it is much more to the point, whereas ChatGPT feels very much like it's trying to be much more conversational all the time. Like, it adds a lot more, I'm going to say, color to just, here's what you asked me for, right?
Yeah, that makes sense to me too, because they're optimizing for the chat experience, right? And Claude is like, here's the model. It's in Bedrock or SageMaker if you want to run it yourself. Do what you want.
Yeah, so here's an example, right? Last night, I was playing around with it, and I'm like, I can't remember the exact prompt, but it was something like along the lines of, I want you to give me 5 potential blog ideas for a topic X. And I put that into Claude, and it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here you go. That's it, right? I put that same thing into ChatGPT, and it's like, okay, here they are, but here's like a 1-sentence summary about each one. Here's why we thought that that answered your question. Here's even a target that might be like a good, like a person that would read that article. It kind of filled in a lot more blanks than what Opus did or what Claude did. I think we might have lost Travers again. Lots of technical issues today. So that is the Bedrock update. We can get all 3 Claude models now. I'm going to wait for Travers to come back for this one. Give him a second to rejoin. Another model update. No Travers. There he is. Hey, you're back.
I'm back.
All right. While you were gone, I was trying to back myself out of that analogy that I essentially said, it's not like talking to a human.
Right.
Anyways, I'm kidding. I wrapped that one up, and I'm not going to use any more analogies for the rest of the day. Here's the other big model update, is you can now get Llama 3 as well on Bedrock. I was going to quickly go in and sort of, you know, request access to this one because I would like to try it out as well, just in the little chat playground or whatever they call it. But I haven't done that yet. So I'm not quite sure what you know about Llama 3.
Yeah, this one is kind of interesting. It performs really well in a lot of benchmarks, but the context window is kind of small on it still. So I'm kind of curious to see what exactly they'll be using it for. I don't know if it says so here, but I was
quickly scanning it.
A couple thousand tokens.
Oh,
so,
which is...
So like, I don't know. It's really like nothing small compared to the big ones, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's just Google. They just haven't, like, Facebook hasn't figured out the secret sauce to getting those huge context windows. I know Google published a paper about getting essentially infinite context to models.
Really?
Yeah, I guess it's a process that can scale massively to grant context to these models, which is how they manage like that, the Gemini. What is it? It's like 200K tokens or something, right?
Something like that,
The needle in the haystack thing they're doing.
Isn't Claude in around the same? Like Claude 3, isn't it around like
100,000?
Yeah.
It's pretty large, yeah.
I hadn't looked at the details of this, but if that context window is is quite small. I guess it depends on what you're really using it for, right? Is it going to make a difference?
That's
or
the
not?
Thing.
But
like, yeah. I think they're making it available in there. They're probably optimizing for Instagram, Facebook chat, that kind of stuff, right?
Okay.
So yeah.
I have tried some of the earlier models, and I thought that like the earlier Llama versions of this, and thought that the responses were quite good, but I did notice, and again, all anecdotal, right? It's just kind of like, as I'm playing around with these things, it felt like it was much, much slower to respond, like to get an answer back than some of the others. And again, you know what, is that a big deal? No. But just sort of as I was playing around with these things, that was my first sort of thought on this one was, it seems quite slow compared to the other ones. Yeah. Let me see here.
Gotcha. Yeah. And again, this is one of the only, there's not a lot of them that are open source, right? It's Llama and, Mistral. And there's a few other, there's some others on Hugging Face, right?
So, okay. So on that comment about open source, I should have put this in the conversation for this week, and I kind of got distracted. Somebody was mentioning that, like, is Llama really open source?
Yeah, that's, you know, yeah, it's interesting.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right, it's more like they published the weights of the model.
Okay.
Like the...
Oh, we might have lost Travers again. Give him a second here. Keeps freezing on us today. As we're waiting for him, I jumped back into Bedrock, and I'm just seeing if we've got that model available or not. We'll give him a second to connect. Lots of technical difficulties this afternoon. Sorry, folks. There he is. Hey.
There we go. I'm back again.
The internet gods are just not playing nicely with you today, are they?
Yep, I'm not favored.
Yeah. As I was waiting for you, I was trying to, and I always forget where this is in the Bedrock console, but I was trying to find, you know, where you go in and you request access to the models. I wanted to see if I could find if I have Llama 3 or not. But you were saying about sort of the open sourcesness of this. Explain that to me.
Yeah. They open source the weights of the model, right? So you don't get access to really the code or the training data, but you get access to the actual values that were used in the neural network, essentially. So that's the extent of the open sourceness. I think Mistral is like that too. But it's not totally open source in the traditional sense, which is kind of interesting.
So is this conversation that, is it really open source? Is it more just like social media fun and games again to
probably
rile people up? Yeah,
I think so.
Well, if I don't have this model, I'll get it turned on. And I did actually RTFM this time. And I looked at the I read a single paragraph. I looked at the bottom, and it says here, so see, I'm wondering, it says Llama Foundation models are available in SageMaker Jumpstart. So maybe it's not available directly in Bedrock at this point. I don't know.
Maybe not.
I'll have to poke around a little bit and see with this one. Because I jumped in, I made sure I was in the right region, and I don't see it in the sort of the list of what you have. I just see the Llama 2 stuff still, but
yeah, they just revealed Llama 3. So
yeah, it's like yesterday, right? So
yeah.
All right. So I think, that's the end of the AWS sort of updates, interesting updates for the week. And I stumbled across this one, and I thought this was awesome. So we talked last week or the week before, you know, about the Eclipse a little bit. Amazon Science here. They visualized the path on the effects of the solar eclipse on Amazon data. And you can literally see that the largest drops in data are right on the path of totality. I just thought this was a really interesting visualization to look at. And it does prove that we can actually make people stop using Amazon, but only if we completely eclipse the sun.
That's the only way.
The only way. Otherwise, people are shopping. People are shopping. Now, the interesting thing here, as you watch this diagram, what's going on in Nevada, I think it is right there, just off to the left. There's just like an internet outage something. You can kind of just see that one little blip, bloop, and then it goes.
Yeah, I wonder.
We'll never know. This actually, you know what? Speaking of the blip there, I didn't put it in the Amazon updates, but I did post on it about it on LinkedIn. Did you happen to stumble across the CloudWatch, the new CloudWatch monitor? It's something like, they call it internet health or something like that. And what it does,
it looks at
the global internet. They call it a weather map, I think, the internet weather map. And it'll show you outages and things that are happening. And it's free of charge. So, you know, if you're kind of wondering what's going on, or maybe you're seeing some odd behavior, it might just be another point of data or another tool that you could use to kind of help understand maybe if you're noticing anything strange in your applications. I thought it was kind of cool. I poked around it a little bit. It just gives you like a little map diagram, and then you can drill into different geographic locations and stuff.
That is really interesting. So you can see if your local area is experiencing an outage or not, or maybe your team in across the world.
Huh. Yeah.
That's cool.
And I thought it was kind of timely because it was after the fact, but I thought in the future we might be able to use it, because I had a customer call me one day last week and said, do you know if anything's going on? Because I'm getting users saying, you know, we're having higher than normal latency and just kind of general sluggishness. And I know that's really hard to, like, how are you going to ever pinpoint that? But maybe with that weather map, if you did have that sort of thing, you might be able to look at it and at least get a sense of maybe what's going on, which could explain something that's happening. I don't know. But I really love this visualization. I thought it was cool.
It's really nice to look at. It's just a sweeping blue line of outage across the whole path of totality.
This entire path of people here, they were all outside staring at the sun.
Yeah.
For at least a couple
there's
minutes.
Like a... There was like another uptick too of Google searches for why do my eyes hurt along the same path.
Oh my God. Okay. So I have a funny story. So first off, I come home after, right? It was in the and I follow somebody and I can totally see her, but I can't remember her name. So bad with names, right? And I follow her on Twitter. She's a sports writer, baseball sports writer, right?
Okay.
So big baseball fan, so great insights. And, but she talks about a lot of other things other than baseball. And she has a picture of herself sitting on her couch, I think, holding her eyes. And she's like, either something's wrong with my eyes or I'm a hypochondriac or something like that. So I bet you there was a lot of that going on after the fact. Like, my eyes don't feel right. You're like, I did everything I was supposed to.
Yeah, man.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Well, even through the glasses, you're not supposed to look at it for more than like 3 minutes sustained. So.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I just stared like the whole time.
Hey, how are your eyes doing?
I bump into a few things here or there, but I'm pretty much okay. What's the worst that could happen, right? I really didn't sit there and stare at it the whole time. But yeah, I thought that's interesting. So we saw a downgrade isn't the right word, but a drop in traffic going to AWS during the eclipse, and we saw an uptick in Google searches of why do my eyes hurt after the fact.
Perfect.
I don't even really know what to say about this one. It just came across my little news feed, and I thought it was interesting in the context of the fact that we talk about AWS, but AWS lost a legal battle, which seems to have been going on for quite a long time, to a company called... It's in here somewhere. Cove.io. Yeah. And it's not for a small amount of money. Half a billion dollars, right? So this talks about in specifically DynamoDB, S3, and other related products and services. And if I'm understanding this correctly, the gist of this is that when we've got these large distributed networks, in order to access data on those large networks very, very quickly, you need a way to know where that data is without actually having the data in every spot. Almost like the way I thought of it, and this is probably an oversimplification of all of this, is just the fact that I need a pointer, right? Like I need to be able to know where that is really quickly, but I know it can't be stored everywhere at one time is kind of the way my simple brain thought about this.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, that's why they have the storage set up in the key-based kind of system, right? When you upload an object, it has, you start with the S3 bucket as like the primary key, basically.
Yeah.
And then each object has keys going down until you get to the actual file.
Yeah. And so you can see here, I've got...
makes sense. It's like Dynamo.
Yeah, I've got a little note here. Like the result was distributed hash values that point to a location information server. So how do you, where do you go find this? Well, it's over there. Now, Amazon says they don't feel that they've done anything wrong and they'll appeal it. But I thought this was just interesting because it's Amazon related, right? Not really much else to say about that. I'm sure this kind of stuff happens all the time and you don't really
all the time.
Yeah.
You hear there's also a company, all kinds of patent issues happen every day. There's companies that survive off of that kind of stuff. So, just trolling for,
trolling for violations, right? All right. This is a good one. We had a very similar article this not too long ago. So this time it's Andy Jassy chiming in saying, hoping that Gen AI will be bigger than cloud or the internet. I think a couple weeks ago we talked about the AWS CEO kind of saying their goal is for Amazon to have 99% of the AI business. So now it's Andy Jassy's turn to chime in. What I thought that was interesting about this was, you know, he's basically saying here, Jassy describes as the bottom layer won't come as a surprise to everyone, basically selling customers the computing resources and software necessary to develop their own models. And he acknowledges that that's going to need a whole heck of a lot of GPUs. And and then they mention here that NVIDIA recently revealed that Amazon's Cebia supercomputer, which never heard of before, initially planned to use Hopper GPUs, will actually be using 20,000 of the newer NVIDIA GPUs that we talked about last week, the Blackwell ones. So this article caught my eye just because of what we talked about last week, this idea of just the chip wars that seem to be happening. And this seems like just another example of that, right?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. NVIDIA has a huge lead and we'll see how that goes. I know AMD is coming up with new stuff and Intel as well. So yeah, that's going to be an interesting couple of years if you're in the chip business.
Yeah. And then the other thing that stood out to me in this article was, you know, we're talking about needing a lot of NVIDIA GPUs. And then somewhere in here, mentions the interest in growing interest in alternative hardware, highlighting Anthropic's plan to use Amazon's homegrown Trainium and I never know how to say that. The other chip.
The Inferentia stuff?
There you go. Inferentia chips. Yeah. So I would assume, again, here, like, hey, these are the chips that we have right now. These are the chips that we could potentially use in the future. So how do we continue to develop our capabilities and next generation of those chips, right? So kind of goes back to the chip war conversation we had last week.
Yeah. How do we get enough chips while also being efficient enough with power so that there's enough to go around?
Yeah. Power is the whole thing. Yeah. I wasn't necessarily thinking about power. I was thinking more like, how do we get the chips we need now to stay in the game?
Oh, sure.
But then how do we build a solution or a system so that later we're less reliant on somebody other than ourselves for these high powered chips that we're going to need, right?
Right.
But obviously, like you said, power is going to be a big deal.
Yeah. Amazon, they'll spin up their own chip division, I'm sure, over the next 5 to 10 years and trying to get in that game.
Well, my recollection is the Graviton processors came from a chip manufacturer that Amazon bought a number of years ago, Israeli based, I think. And I even think that the Trainium and the The other one that I can't say that I won't try again is, I think those came from Amazon's
from that
internal development. They purchased that company. That's my recollection. So to your point, though, I would suspect that they're going to invest lots of time and effort there to sort of remove the dependency maybe on another manufacturer, right?
Yeah.
And Andy Jassy again here. This is a huge letter to shareholders. And obviously, Amazon business is massive, and we only talk about one little bit of it. But there are some interesting insights here. Let me zoom in a bit. Right. So they talk about Amazon advertising. They talk about Amazon grocery. They talk about the retailer. But specific on AWS here, $85 billion annualized revenue run rate. They're saying here, despite a 29% year-over-year growth, they're facing short-term headwinds as companies become more cautious in spending.
Right.
Which makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, obviously on a much, much smaller scale, we're having lots of conversations with customers on this kind of thing too, right? Like how could we extract a few bucks from this without affecting the solutions, but how could I save a few bucks here and there? Because everybody's got tighter budgets right now, right?
Yeah, just because of the interest rate climate in general, right? That's causing a lot of people to tighten up. So
Yeah. And you'll see here, it says, one of the many advantages of AWS and cloud computing is that when your business grows, you can seamlessly scale up. And conversely, if your business contracts, you can, you know, give us some of that compute time back and we can sell it to somebody else. I like this idea. Like, I like it as a marketing concept. However, in real life, at least the types of customers that we're dealing with, a lot of them are just, I shouldn't say just, they're running off-the-shelf software on a VM that they don't have to manage anymore, right? They don't have to manage the underlying hardware. Many of them can't necessarily take full advantage of this idea of auto-scaling because of licensing requirements or some sort of specific thing in that vendor software. So I see this as a big advantage if you're building greenfield solutions.
If you're in the serverless space or you're roasting a site in a web app in Beanstalk or things like that, right?
Yeah. So I thought it was a good article. It's huge. And like I said, I spent my time just looking at the AWS piece, and I thought it was interesting here. Our sales and support teams are spending much of their time helping customers optimize their spend. And I would say, again, to my earlier point, right, we've seen that in our own little ecosystem as well of customers where, you know, how can we extract a few bucks from this to help the bottom line? So interesting article, worth a read. And then this one, Atlas, Boston Dynamics.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to play the video. Get rid of the sound. This is the part that got me the most.
Great. It's great radio.
It's great radio. You can't hear anything.
Yeah.
The way the robot stands up, I said to you that it reminds me of the trend in horror films right now that you've got, somebody crawling really weirdly on the floor or whatever. And I was like, oh man, that's like straight out of a horror film that you see sort of
straight out of The Exorcist. Yeah.
Yeah. But you said some interesting things about this. What do you think about Atlas?
So what's really interesting about this, we've seen video of the old Boston Dynamics robots, right? And they're hydraulically powered generally. So this thing is entirely electric. So you just have to plug it in, charge it, and it's human height, and it seems to be able to walk around and do human level tasks. Like, it looks pretty useful for, labor jobs. You should be scared. My mind's just kind of fried looking at it, honestly.
Yeah. I'm kind of scared in the fact that it looks like it's looking at me without really looking at me, and then it turns its entire body around. It's slightly creepy, right? It's slightly horror film-ish kind of thing.
So the video started with it lying on the ground, and then it kind of gets itself up, but its torso is facing the wrong way. So its torso kind of rises up behind it as it's standing up, and then it twists around and walks towards the camera. And its head is just a black mirror, essentially. with like a ring light around it. So it just, you stare into your own eyes when you're looking at it. And
as its legs rotate around. So it's now like, it sort of reminds me of, there's a real movie theme going on here today. Remember Will Smith's iRobot?
Way back
in the days? Yeah. It's got this creepy vibe to it. I think it's really, to your point, right? Human-sized. It's completely electric, so just plug it and charge it, right? And being able to do human-type tasks, it's pretty incredible. Yeah. It's a little unnerving when you see it in that little video.
It's uncanny. Yeah,
yeah. I'm interested to see the next videos of these things that come out. And actually seeing it do a couple interesting things. Because we had that video from the other robotic company that's funded, I think, in part by Jeff Bezos, right? Remember when we had that?
Yeah, showing figure,
it,
right?
Yeah, and it was unloading things off of a belt and stuff like that. So I wouldn't be shocked if we see some similar videos from Boston Dynamics on those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, this is the kind of stuff that... personally, I'm really excited for, again, I'll say it again, with all of this GPU production in the simulation space, is that you can use that compute tech to train and simulate control systems for these kinds of human-like machines to do more general tasks, right? And that's what they're talking about. I think it says athletic intelligence there, connections between perceptions to adapt on the fly. So yeah, they train them dynamically, which is fascinating.
Oh, and there's the original. I'm scrolling down a little bit. So we've got, I don't remember what it was called, but we've got the original bot that we've seen lots of.
Oh, yeah.
Doing the obstacle courses and stuff like that. So it doesn't look like they've got any other videos here of the new guy doing anything. This is all the previous generation by the looks of it. But it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, the other thing I'm interested about Atlas is that they've kind of said that they don't necessarily need to do it completely in the human form factor. Like, if you notice, it's not exactly tied to the kind of joint ligature, that kind of the same kind of body structure, right? It has reversible hip joints, reversible arm joints. It can pivot on all those axes. So you don't necessarily need to be tied to the human form factor. I think like the Tesla bot is like that. And I can't remember the figure eight. Yeah, the figure AI bot. How that's structured, but I think it's also pretty human-like.
I did notice that its joints don't seem normal.
Yeah. Well, that's how it was able to do that horrifying stand-up.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I you know what? When you think about it, it makes a lot of sense for it to be able to, you know, get up off the ground and stuff like that in specific spaces, maybe, and things. It's obviously, you want it to be much more, I'll use the word flexible than a human body could be. But when you watch it, it's a little weird.
It's a little uncanny.
Yeah, it's a little weird. But lots of fun happening there. And then our last one, and this reminds me of something we talked about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about, I think you were mentioning NVIDIA specifically coming out with some models around medical things and everything. So when I found this one, I thought it was pretty interesting and just had some context from a previous week. So this is University of Cambridge using machine learning and AI to speed up design of new drugs for Parkinson's. And it says in the heading there, tenfold, but they also mention, so tenfold in speed, right? But they also mention some things that we've talked about a couple times in the podcast, reducing the cost. So I think they said something like 1,000-fold reduction in cost. And then they're using AI to teach itself. So they get some early feedback. They get some early results.
Yep.
They do some testing and feed that back into AI and then does its analysis and sort of tightens up its sort of suggestions and says, hey, focus on this kind of these specific things. So they're using AI to kind of basically get them started. They do some experimental work, feed that experimental work back in, and then AI refines the responses again, tells them where to look next. So I thought this was impressive.
Yeah, you tighten up the feedback loop, the iteration cycle, right? So you get more research done, which is just amazing. Like, this is, robots are cool. Don't get me wrong. I'm excited about the robot stuff, but this is the most important part of this.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be the biggest deal.
Yeah,
this kind of research assisting tech, especially for medical applications is like 10x efficiency or speed up in drug development is huge. They spend billions of dollars developing a single drug, right?
Yeah. So. And somewhere in this article, they said that, you know, you mentioned the cost of it, but there's also the time that it takes to do it, where it could be like decades.
6 years. Yeah.
And even then, yeah, they said that the success rate is so low, you spend decades working on stuff and you were working on stuff that wasn't correct, isn't the right word, but you spend a lot of time to find out that it isn't the most promising thing that you had on your plate,
right,
but you've spent a decade working on it and they're able to, again, tighten up all that stuff. So to your point, this is the stuff that I think, to your comment, is obviously the most important thing that we could be spending our time on, I would think, right?
With AI, Greg, it's definitely,
yeah. Improving the human condition, I think, is important. Robots are cool. And I do want a robot to do a lot of the things I don't want to do.
Yeah.
But having the ability to improve somebody's health through, you know, drug optimizations and specific therapies that are maybe for that person, I think that is obviously, you can't put a value on that, right?
No, it's priceless.
Yeah.
Maybe you get closer to like the promise of customized medicine down the line in like 50 years or whatever, right?
But yeah, pretty cool. So that's the articles for the week. That's right. The show. What do we got?
Wow.
Shameless plugs for the week. Oh, we are doing special episode next week. We're going to have a few really smart folks join us from AWS, and we're going to dedicate the whole 45-ish hour on just Gen AI, but specifically sort of how you could potentially be using Gen AI, roadblocks, skill gaps, and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'll be a great discussion. We get to learn from the horse's mouth proverbially what's going on with those services. And I think it'll be fun. So show up.
Yeah. And we'll do it on Twitch again. There's no reason or no requirement to register for it. But I did find a little service that I'll use, and I'll post some links on LinkedIn over the next couple days as we get through the weekend. so that if you wanted a reminder here or there, that it'll do that as well. So I'll get that all set up and sent out on Monday. That way, if you're like me and you need a calendar reminder to tell you where you're supposed to be, we'll get that going. Perfect. Well,
all right.
Thanks everybody. As usual, I'll throw up the outro screen here and enjoy your weekend. Bye for now.
Yeah, take care.